Today with Clare Byrne on RTE Radio 1.
So it's time for the Friday gathering, and I'm joined in the studio by Fine Gael Senator and Shannon spokesperson on Justice Barry Ward, Louise O'Reilly, Sinn Féin TD for Dublin Fingal and party spokesperson on enterprise, trade and employment, Professor Niamh Harrigan, sociologist and vice president for academic affairs at Mary Immaculate College in Limerick, and Philip Ryan, political editor at Independent Newspapers. And you're all very welcome. Thank you for being here. We'll start off with this Pascal Donoghue situation. Barry, we're going to have another statement from him on Tuesday. I don't know if you heard Barry Cowan earlier this morning saying, look, we need a full explanation, obviously. But he was saying some sort of censure, some sort of suspension might be in order rather than people calling for him to resign. What do you say?
Well, if there is found to be wrongdoing, I mean, it's an appropriate thing. There has to be some marking of it. But what I would say is that at the outset, nobody seems to doubt Pascal Donoghue is a good, honest person with integrity. I don't think there's anybody saying that that isn't the case. And I must say, from my own point of view, when I talk to people locally, nobody's raising this issue with me. But Pascal Donoghue himself has said this is important and integrity in public office is important. I know he's going to deal with that on Tuesday and I look forward to what he has to say. If it is adjudged by SIPO that something has to be done about that, then yes, that is appropriate. Absolutely.
Are you disappointed with how he's dealt with it so far? We had the press conference on Sunday, then we had the statement in the Dáil, criticised for not taking questions, and now we see he has to do it again next Tuesday.
No, I don't think so. I wouldn't describe how I feel about it as disappointed. I'm disappointed with how it has been dealt with perhaps by others. But the point that I would make about Pascal is that he's come forward.
Which others do you mean?
I think that some of the criticisms that have been put out there have been quite unfair. There's been a lot of misinformation put out there as well about what he has actually said and what the actual fact is. And some of the allegations have been levelled by people who are not really in a position to cast stones. But I'm not here to talk about that.
You're talking about the party represented by the person beside you,
Louise
O'Reilly.
Absolutely. But I honestly think people are very tired of the point scoring that has been seen in this from both sides. So I'm not interested in that. What I would say about Pascal is he was clearly unaware of issues, and that has you know, put him on the back foot to a certain extent. But everything he said, I think, has been completely forthright. He has responded to calls for another statement, and he's going to take questions, as I understand it, on Tuesday. So the original statement that he made on Wednesday night was under, I think, Standing Order 55 of the Dáil. That is at the discretion of the Cán Comhairle, and he gave a pretty full account of what happened there. But if people want to ask questions, then he has, as he has said from the beginning, will make himself available for questions.
Do you think this is a ball of smoke?
I think more is being made of it than is appropriate, because the reality is that, as I said, I don't believe anyone is suggesting that there's nefarious intent on Pascal Donoghue's part. I think people recognise that he's a good, straight person who has worked incredibly hard for his constituents and always shown integrity.
Philip Ryan, you might be a good person to come to next on this, because your own headline in The Independent says Donoghue on the ropes. Are you making more of it than it warrants?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so at all. I think it is an important story. There's one aspect that you can say, oh, it's all a bit silly. It's about posters and things like that. And the amount of money involved is only, you know, small change to the likes of Fine Gael senators, maybe. But at the same time, it is important because it shows in one way the way things are done in this country in a lot of times. The basics of it are businessman pays for a politician's posters to be put up. Businessman subsequently gets put on one board that is overseeing the regeneration of said politician's constituency. That's nice to have there, isn't it? Two people working on together to make sure your constituency is looked after.
Didn't take a fee for that, did he?
Didn't take a fee, but I'm just saying it works well for everybody. Same businessman gets put on the board of the Land Development Agency. A businessman involved in engineering, involved in construction, etc., is now sitting on the board of, and again, doesn't take fees, and that's very that's fair enough and fair play to him, but is put on the board of a very powerful agency that's involved in master planning and developing the entire country. So, like, you mightn't take your 15 grand fee, but the level of access you have is extraordinary. And on top of that, as we can see, because it's to do with the North Inner City Regeneration Task Force, he gets to meet the Minister of Finance or the Minister for Public Expenditure, whoever it was, a couple of times a year, if not three or four times in some instances. That's a great level of access as well.
Now, what you could say, though, is that Michael Stone would have expected his dealings with Pascal Donoghue to be dealt with appropriately. And we know Pascal Donoghue has apologised to him for what's happened over the course of the last week, and there's no suggestion that there's any wrongdoing there on his part. Louise, the accusations that were levelled at you there by Barry Ward, the way this is being dealt with, the accusations that are being levelled at Pascal Donoghue, that this is just going too far, what do you say?
The minister himself could have dealt with this in 2017. when the matter was raised with him, and it would have been appropriate for him to address it. I mean, there is a facility there to make an amendment. SIPO give that. There's recognition that people can make mistakes, and the facility is there. So in 2017, the minister was queried about this. He pushed back. He said nothing to see here. He made no amendment. He made no public statement about it. Again, in November 2022, when media queries were sent into his office, his response was nothing to see here, absolutely nothing to be done. And now we find that this 5 years on from 6 years nearly on from the first time it was raised with him is only now getting dealt with. The minister has made two statements to the Dáil. He's done one very hastily convened press conference, and there are still questions that fall to be answered. And those questions were asked not just by Piers Doherty, but by Piers Doherty and other members of the opposition. The minister himself knows that those questions weren't answered, and now he has to come back into the Dáil. Or indeed, as Peter Burke signalled last night on RTE, he may come out at some stage over the weekend. So I don't know how long it's going to take him to get this new version of his story straight, and when we're going to see him come out. But there does have to be political accountability for this. You know, this was a donation from a powerful businessman to the Minister for Public Expenditure and Reform, now Minister for Finance, as was, and indeed in 2016 he would have been a junior minister going into that election. So this is somebody who's very close to government, somebody who had a donation made to him and didn't correctly account for it, didn't take the opportunity twice when that was afforded to him to make an amendment to his declaration. And now he finds himself, he is the author of this entirely himself. He didn't take any opportunity to correct the record. And now he finds himself having to come in again for a third time to make a statement to the Dáil.
Niamh, what do you say?
I think, in fairness, Pascal Donoghue is paying a price. And I would agree with Louise. I think this has been extraordinarily messy. In some sense, I think Pascal, compared to some other members of government, has historically, I think, had quite an easy ride from the media. And I think he's struggling to cope with being in the centre of the spotlight of this kind of critical view. But I think the government is paying a price for the real underdevelopment and weakness of SIPO for 21 years. And I know this has been recognised and it's been acknowledged, but the greyness around this and the struggle to actually define what has happened, what is the penalty, is in large part due to the slow pace of reform of SIPO. And just to be clear, if we look at something like the revenue commissioners, if we look at the courts, they all are organisations which are engaged with looking at wrongdoing, and they have a model of proportionality, which then looks at what are the sanctions when someone has been caught doing wrongdoing. I think, in fairness, Pascal has already acknowledge to a certain extent that there is wrongdoing or there is an issue here. The fact that there is no, and I thought Barry Cowan's comments earlier, Claire, were really interesting. The fact that the government themselves have not allowed any gradation of wrongdoing means that you can't simply say, well, you did wrong, slap on the wrist or whatever. I have to say, though, and it comes back to Philip's point about the actual amount of money involved here. If the implication here is that it's some kind of a cash for access or cash for honours, it seems to be that we have very cheap honours and access by the standards of the Western world. That doesn't negate the wrongdoing here, but I do think it means we need a much more refined and nuanced way of looking at standards in public office, because SIPO just is not cutting it.
And I think that SIPO themselves, sorry, just to finish out on that, SIPO themselves have been looking for additional powers. So they would have sent, during Pascal Donoghue's term in office, he would have been in receipt of two reports from them where they were looking for this.
They're not opposed in that regard, Louise. Like, it's in the programme for government to increase those powers. Everybody agrees on that, it just hasn't happened yet.
Done, and two reports have been received.
Sorry, you can't do everything immediately.
Okay, can I speak? You've been in government for 12 years. Okay, so
we've had other more important issues to deal with.
Absolutely, and accountability is incredibly important, is. Barry. And if it's not a priority for the government, that's deeply worrying. 12 years of Fine Gael in government and no reform of SIPO, despite the fact that SIPO have looked for this.
There is a real problem with this narrative, and Philip said it as well. This is the way things are done in this country. It is not the way things are done in this country. There is massive access to politicians in this country in a way that there isn't in any other Western democracy. But you don't have to give a donation to have access to your local politician, and any TD or senator or councillor around the country will tell you that. And the narrative that there is not accountability is really destructive and quite untrue. The reality is that politicians are not only accountable in the case of ministers to the Dáil, but they're accountable to their electorates, and they're accountable to SIPO, and they're accountable to the guards, and they're accountable to any number of other regulatory agencies. and they are constantly called to Louise. They're constantly, excuse me now, Louise. They are constantly called to account, as we have seen in the context of this government with a number of ministers. When things are found to have gone wrong, ministers are accountable, politicians are accountable, and they do answer when things have gone wrong. So don't suggest that there is an accountability. There is.
Can I ask you how far Sinn Féin is going to push this in the context of what Barry Cowan said this morning about their, you know, us going from zero to resignation? What is it that you're looking for? And would you be happy with suspension and perhaps a fine?
We're looking for answers from the minister. You know, he was asked dozens of questions when he made his statement, and he didn't answer one of them. So we are looking for not just for accountability, absolutely for accountability, but we're also looking for answers. And again, we see, and we saw it with Robert Troy, that, you know, ministers have to be dragged kicking and screaming.
That's not true.
Right.
He went in voluntarily, Louise. He applied to the Cian Chóla for time to make the statement on Wednesday night. The Cian Chóla set the format of that, but he did that voluntarily.
But, so Barry,
again,
I understand
the narrative
that
you're
you have
trying
been briefed to say that.
No,
and
sorry,
I absolutely respect your position.
Are you saying it's not true?
But you know, and I know, that the minister would not have come in front of the Dáil were it not for the fact that the opposition were demanding it. You know that,
we don't
and
know
I
that.
Know that.
We don't know
Philip,
that.
Philip, what have you got to say about that?
We know this. We know this.
Just on the point, on the CEPO point, I'd like to go back to, because I don't really, I don't want to cast aspersions on anybody here, but I don't really think that there's going to be any proper reform of CEPO anytime soon. Like you say, there hasn't been over the recent years, despite CEPO going, look, because they do get criticised an awful lot. I've criticised them myself, that they look into political issues, they look into controversies, and they don't do a whole lot, or they don't find a whole lot, and they always come back and say, well, the legislation doesn't let us do anything. And
well, they're underfunded, in fairness.
Underfunded.
Yeah. They can't investigate anything where there hasn't been a formal complaint about
these
it.
Type of
it's
things
extremely
as well.
Onerous to yeah. make a
but
formal
I don't believe
complaint.
Sinn Féin, Sinn Féin, it's not in Sinn Féin's interest, it's not in Fine Gael's interest for them to have any real
no,
powers.
No, it is, Philip.
And you know you won't. And the other side of it is,
set up by
Sinn Féin, you circumvent them and you put your money through the North in your six counties
organisation.
That's
the
truth, though. You know
we operate in two jurisdictions,
you know,
Philip, as
yeah.
you know,
and
we
when
comply
you get
with
a
the
certain
rules,
amount of money that doesn't
we
fit with
the rules
here
the rules
in the South. You put them through the North.
All we can do is comply with the rules in both jurisdictions where the party operates, and we do that.
And
we comply with those rules.
The rules which are being drafted on the electoral register are the electoral reforms, which will require you to give open and transparent details of how much you get in all jurisdictions, which isn't
so
the case at the moment.
At the moment, the electoral reform bill is being debated, and we have participated in that. We've also made amendments to strengthen it, as you will know, because I know you've been following it. So we do believe in accountability. But I mean, it's not lost on people listening. 12 years of Fine Gael in government, and they're saying now, oh yes, we're all about accountability and we're absolutely going to get CIPO reformed. CIPO have been screaming for these powers now for years. They should have been given to them. And it just happens that the man who had the responsibility of taking that report from CIPO now finds himself in the firing line. And now we're back again to people talking about accountability, which is very important. But we don't see any action from the government. We've had 12 years of Fine Gael in government.
They did before, Philip. This was set up by
exactly,
government in 1995.
Yeah, and look at where it is.
Yeah, and
that's
it
exactly
is in the programme for
the
government.
Point
no,
by saying that.
I'm not sorry. You're suggesting the politicians
won't
settle
it. A weak, toothless tiger of an investigative process that has...
Philip,
where they have brought someone to account.
No, but hang on a second, Philip. The reality is that all of the limits on political donations, political expenditure, all of that was brought in by politicians from 1995 onwards, supported by Fine Gael, amended by Fine Gael, improved by Fine Gael. Now, you're quite right. There need to be more powers for CIPO. That's something that Fine Gael is in favour of. It's in the programme for government. It hasn't happened yet, but it will. That is right. And there are other things in the programme of government that haven't been gotten around to. There have also... Sinn Féin can keep saying 12 years,
but I disagree.
There were other major crises in
the
meantime.
It's the duration of the
term.
I think it's very significantly actually in the interests of politicians that we have stronger CIPO regulation, because if we look at what happened with the banking crisis, if we look at what happened with all... And I mean, it's so interesting that we're still feeding in the findings of the Moriarty Tribunal and the Mahon Tribunal into the electoral reform bill. But, you know, if we had a stronger kind of gradated mode of sanction for wrongdoing, which does happen. I mean, in fairness, if you're a minister for finance or minister for anything, that's a really busy job. Mistakes do happen. If if we had a nuanced way of sanctioning, like we do in the courts, like revenue operate, like then this would be a non-story, effectively. The very grayness, the very weakness of SIPO has turned this into a massive story because everyone is flailing around going, what do we do? There's been wrongdoing. The money is relatively small by the standard of what's going on in the state, but there is no solution. And it's a massive weakness for our politicians that this is the case. And I have to say, I think if this is not pushed through in the term of this government, the government themselves will be deeply, deeply sorry in the next 5 to 10 years.
No, I think it's important that it's done. But I also think we need to note that there are, you know, SIPO is the body that are responsible, and it's important that they have the powers and the resources. I think when we talk about powers, we need to talk about matching resources. But we also need to recognise that there is political accountability, and that happens on the floor of the Dáil. And that's why we'll see the minister back again for the third time now, because
second
he didn't.
Time,
it's the third. He made two statements.
It's
his third
Wednesday
statement.
Night.
He made two statements on Wednesday.
He came before the Dáil once on Wednesday night. This
he made
the
two
time
statements
on
Wednesday, and he'll make a third on Tuesday.
All right, I want to move on now, because these reports about what's going to happen to refugees and asylum seekers from here on, we could be looking at large scale homelessness, we're told. We could be looking at people not being offered a bed but being given vouchers for food. What, Barry Ward, is the long term plan here, or is there any?
Well, the long term is the plan, the same plan in terms of housing generally. Obviously there's a demand to be met, and that has to be done, and that we can see results in that regard even in last year, and it's continuing. In terms of the pressures, there are, I suppose, two parallel pressures. One is for people who need that kind of permanent, reliable, secure housing, on people who are here.
I'm talking specifically about refugees and asylum seekers who will be left homeless, we're told.
And that is a separate issue, because they require a different type of housing. But there's no doubt there is pressure coming, pressure that wasn't foreseen this time last year, even, because the Ukraine war is less than a year in place. But Roderick O'Gorman and others have said that they are working to solve this problem, and I have confidence that they will do that. There will be difficulties, though, and there will be people who will be in housing that we would not choose as the first place to put people coming to this country seeking protection.
There'll be no housing, is what we're told this morning. Homeless on the streets.
If you go back 9 months, people were saying the government couldn't possibly accommodate refugees coming from Ukraine, for example. 70,000 people have come here from Ukraine, and for the most part, they have been accommodated.
And do you foresee the greater use of tented accommodation now?
I think that's probably a reality to it. It is. It's not, as I say, it's not ideal.
How do you feel about that?
I'm not happy about it, but I also
have you seen it? Have you?
I saw the one in Gormanstown. Yes, it was opened last year.
And what was it like?
I'm going to say it's comfortable. I wouldn't choose to live in it myself, but it's dry and it's secure, and it's better than if some of the places people are coming from. That doesn't mean it's ideal. It doesn't mean it's desirable, but it may be necessary in the short term. And I respect the fact that Roderick O'Gorman has been very upfront about this, and he has said that there is a coming problem. And we know that there is. We hope it'll be short term. Mm-hmm. And we don't know exactly how things will turn in terms of that pressure in the coming months.
Niamh, Justine McCarthy has an article in the Irish Times today about a vacant hotel here down the road, saying, why can't we use the 400 odd bedrooms there? And that's something you're frustrated about as well,
Absolutely,
of the unused property.
I suppose in terms of short term, and I suppose somebody who's a registrar of a third level institution has been dealing with student accommodation crisis for the last 2 years, I can tell you that kind of short term, low cost, even low cost kind of temporary accommodation, that is pretty much full to brim now. And so therefore, I think there's two pieces I think that need to happen fairly urgently with this. The first is, in terms of vacant and derelict homes, we need a use it or lose it regulation as a matter of urgency. It won't actually solve things in the next 6 weeks to 2 months, but in the medium term, it would make a massive, massive difference. The second,
what does that mean, use it or lose it? Does that mean compulsory purchase or what?
It can mean compulsory purchase. It has different elements in different countries. So in some cases, it's compulsory purchase, particularly if there's dereliction. And there was some movements on this by local authorities, which then seem to kind of backpedal. The other thing is, of course, to use a vacant homes tax and to make it basically, and I mean, we had vacant homes, but it wasn't meaningful enough to actually make any impact. But we have, anybody who's looked at Derelict Ireland on Twitter, to see the amount of vacant and derelict buildings which could actually be used. And the other piece, I suppose, and this could also be, is, I mean, in Limerick City at the moment, we have so much vacant commercial property, vacant offices in a city where nobody can find a place to live, right? And all the current plans by the local authority for the city focus on more retail units and more offices. So there is a kind of bizarre strategic failure going on here. The refugee crisis is simply bringing it to a head. But I suppose my concern would be if we have large-scale homelessness as a consequence of that, our social cohesion, and we've seen it start to fracture already. None of us want this. This is terrible for Irish society. Then this, we have to move urgently on this. This nettle has to be grasped, and what's being outlined so far ain't going to solve it.
It's a huge political problem, Philip, as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it certainly is. And Barry said that over the last 12 years, reforming SEPA was on top of the agenda. And also, housing really wasn't on top of the government's agenda for much of the last 12 years. And that's really why we're in this situation to a large part, that the accommodation crisis in this country hasn't been addressed. It's only in recent years that it is moving towards a situation where it's been treated like the proper crisis that it is. You can't blame the government for what's happened in the Ukraine. Mm-hmm. You can't blame the government what's happened in other countries in North Africa or into further Eastern Europe, and people who are outside the EU who want to come here because the countries they live in just aren't fit for their purposes. So they want a better life. They want a better life for themselves. They want a better life for their families. They don't want to be bombed in some apartment block in Kiev. So look, and you have to bear that in mind. And it is awful to see the divisiveness that's seeping into the discourse over here. And maybe it's given a bit too much play, like the idea that this far right is on the move and is building up, because it doesn't really seem like it. The organisations behind it are very small.
Yeah, except if you're in a hotel room and you're 8 years old and you're hearing out, that's
course,
a massive issue for
of course
you,
it is, but I mean, does it have to be on every single news bulletin and across every newspaper in the country because 10 lads show up and act like
I think it was more than 10
no,
and they
I
were
know,
quite widespread,
you know that, you know,
and they were in different geographical locations as well. But this thing, you know, you can't blame the government for the war. We're coming into tourism season now, and those hotels who are being asked, will you move from hosting Ukrainians to hosting asylum seekers? Many of them aren't going to host anybody who's looking for refuge or asylum because they're going to go back into tourism. Now, you can't blame the government for the war, but can you lay at the government's door that they didn't plan for this? We're a year in.
Well, the point I'm making about it's the housing crisis that's the problem that's fed into this. If there was a huge amounts of accommodation and extra capacity in various places, then there would be these beds, but there's not because it hasn't been addressed over recent years, and that's the bedrock of this problem, really.
But I think you were asking, Claire, about what it would be like for people living in those tents. It'll be freezing. It's absolutely Baltic, and they will be freezing. So I suppose the question is for those people who are going to be coming here now is, what exactly are the government prepared to do in acknowledgement of the emergency that has developed? So I mean, it's not lost on people. There's 11,500 people in emergency accommodation. We were in the grip of a housing crisis. The government had said they were preparing to accommodate 200,000 refugees from Ukraine, and I think the failure to address adequately the people who wanted to open their homes, that wasn't dealt with correctly.
Right.
That was let to slide. And I think that's a grave mistake on the part of the government.
I'm watching the clock, and I just want to ask you about the Northern Ireland Protocol comments made by the Taoiseach this morning in an interview with the BBC. And Louise, I'll start with you on that. He said he had some regrets over the protocol being imposed on Northern Ireland without the support of unionists and nationalists. What's your reaction to that?
Well, if you talk to business people in the north and you talk to workers in the north, they'll tell you that the protocol is delivering for them. But having said that, if there have to be accommodations, if there have to be tweaks, well, then that has to happen. But the most important thing is that the DUP end their boycott of Stormont and actually get around the table, form an executive and start dealing with the cost of living crisis that is impacting on people in the north. They need and they deserve.
I just think
an
executive. What you're seeing with the Taoiseach now, and you've seen this since Christmas, is that his softening of the tone from the EU side, from Ireland's side, is to lure, let's say, the unionists, the DUP, back in and to create a kind of mood where there is going to be a final solution.
It's not about luring, but it is about being conciliatory. I think that's really important. The time for...
So he's learned then from the past.
He's learned, but he's the Taoiseach and he has a responsibility and he has to deal with this issue on an ongoing basis. So he's absolutely right to put himself on a footing where he can deal with that.
On the job losses, we heard about Microsoft this morning, following on from other job losses over the course of the last couple of weeks. Indeed, Argos on the retail side, Niamh. Does that inform how your college operates, what students are looking for, the advice that you give them when you see something like this happening in a sector?
It certainly will. I mean, students always make kind of judgments based on where the job market is at the moment. We saw, I think it was Accountancy Ireland come out this morning giving out about accountancy and the leaving cert because the course hasn't been reformed for 20 or 30 years. It's putting everyone off accountancy. I do think generally, certainly in our space, which is very much focused on initial teacher education, in tough times, that rockets up and there's huge demand.
They all come back.
There's huge demand all the time anyway. Certainly, I mean, it's interesting if you look at the tech space that really where you're seeing the contractions is in areas like HR, less so in the kind of hard engineering. Certainly, my sense in terms of trends within the CAO, and I'm very much involved in the CAO, is that those hard skills through engineering are still going to be very popular amongst youngsters for some time to come. And tech, generally, post-COVID, we have a whole generation of kids who are so technologically savvy that they're not going to fall out of love with tech anytime soon.
You just wonder, Phil, because governments say every time we have an announcement like this, look, we have a very solid foundation here and it's a really strong marketplace when it comes to tech. Like, the more this goes on, the deeper this gets, that line won't hold up.
You would worry about that, of course, but at the same time, when you look at technology in recent years, just something new keeps getting invented or some new technology emerges, and all these people who have these skills, they seem to be able to just apply them to whatever's next. If you're a programmer, you can do the sort of program. If you're a tech engineer, you can do this similar tech engineer. And it just seems, it does seem like a growing industry, you know, like a few years ago, no one knew what TikTok was.
I think
was,
with COVID, though, people, it wasn't something that we really talked about that much during COVID because we were so focused on health. But essentially, that closing down meant that everybody was then using tech to go out into the world in the way that they were previously using their 2 feet.
When we used to sit at home with the Argus magazines.
You see this massive bubble in tech, which in many ways, Claire, if you look at kind of the laws of economics, it's not surprising that there was going to be some kind of contraction in tech post. I suppose the question, and this is always the kind of economic crystal ball reeling, is it going to be a hard or a soft landing? And sure,
there is a very good environment for graduates today, ironically, thanks to Pascal Donoghue, in terms of the job market and the level of employment that we have. It's a very hopeful place for people to go, and anybody who's getting bad news today from Argus or Microsoft or whoever it is can rely on the fact that there are supports there for them and hopefully another job, because we have
essentially 100% unemployment. I think we do need to see an action plan for jobs. Like, there hasn't been one since Richard Bruton was Minister for Enterprise, and I would hope that the new minister, Minister Coveney, will actually get to work on that, because I think that's important.
All right, our time is up. Thank you all very much for being here today. That's all from us. Thank you for listening. Today's programme produced by Deirdre Lyne. The series producer is Alistair McConnell. Kieran Dunn was our researcher. Louise Kerr-Ross, our broadcast coordinator. Cara O'Hare was on sound. And my thanks to the entire team this week. Now it's over to Louise Duffy.